Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 135, entitled, How to Survive Any Type of Disaster Scenario and Prep for the Future, I chat with survival expert Jim Cobb. Jim Cobb is a survivalist, author, and expert prepper, and in today's episode, he talks about how to prepare for any disaster or doomsday scenario and how to keep you and your loved ones safe. He shares with us his best tips for preparing for the event of something very bad happening and shares with us sound and practical advice for surviving any such event. If you're wondering how to keep yourself safe, how to prepare for any disaster that might strike in the future, and what survival skills you need to know, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Also, the links mentioned throughout the episode are in the show notes if you are interested in checking out some of the products and resources that Jim or myself mention in this episode. So you can just click on the link, whether you're in iTunes or whether you go to elitemanmagazine.com. They're always in the show notes for this and any Elite Man podcast episode. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com. And my guest today is none other than Jim Cobb from survivalweekly.com and also the book Prepper's Long-Term Survival Guide. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Well, thanks for having me. I look forward to it.
Yeah, man, I'm really excited to have you on the show. I actually have been wanting to do a survival slash prepper guide episode for like the longest time, and I just haven't been able to get it done. So you're like actually our first survivalist.
Okay.
And prepper guide that we've ever had on here. So I'm going to pick your brain for a lot of stuff, man, because I'm excited and I hope you're ready.
Not a problem at all.
All right, Jim. So before we get into some of these incredible tips, and I mentioned your book actually a minute ago as well, The Prepper's Long-Term Survival Guide, an incredible book, man. I actually ordered it a couple weeks back and I've been just, you know, going through every page, and every page is like so awesome, man. Like so many great tips, so much great advice in it. But before we dive into some of that stuff and talk about some of these amazing tips, how do you get started in something like this? Like, where did it all begin for you? I know you mentioned before the call about 30 years ago you were into this stuff, but how did you kind of come up with the site and the book, and, you know, take it from there, man?
Well, as I told you before we got started, I've been interested in this stuff for about 3 decades. And I started at a very young age. I was 10, 11 years old, and it just seemed like common sense to me to want to be prepared for, you know, life's little emergencies, you know, a tornado or a fire or whatever. I was in, you know, scouts for a little while, and there's that whole be prepared concept as well. I'm sure that was a factor. And I just, you know, I kind of, you know, dove right in, getting books from the library, and, you know, obviously there was no internet back then. It was strictly books and magazines, things like that, reading all I could about it, and, you know, to some degree going out into the woods and, you know, pretending I was living off the land, building forts and making fires and all that fun stuff. And as I got older, naturally, I kind of fell away from it for a little while when I became far more interested in the types of things that teenage boys become interested in, and eventually met my wife, or the woman who would become my wife, in my early 20s. We got married, settled down, bought a house, and that's right around when Y2K was starting to build. You know, oh, yeah. And people were talking about Y2K, and I had no fear that, you know, suddenly society was going to collapse because somebody didn't program the computers right. But having those topics showing up in the media all over the place kind of reignited that fire in me about wanting to be prepared for other emergencies and wanting to learn these different survival techniques, things like that. So I kind of, you know, reinvested my energy and refocused back into that, and I've been doing it ever since. Around oh, what was it, like 2008, 2009, I sat down with a few friends of mine who had similar interests, and we decided to get together and put together this website called survivalweekly.com. And the primary intent behind that website initially was to try to counteract the bad information that we kept seeing showing up on the internet, because you'd have a lot of people who, they didn't know any better. They would read a tip or a technique online, and then they would just puke that out again on their website or on their blog, and it would just build and build and build, and it was bad information based on bad information. So we decided we were going to put together this website and, you know, try to counteract that as best we could. Over the course of time, pretty much everybody dropped off the website other than me. And there was a woman named Deborah Moore. She's also an author. She stuck around for quite a while on the website, doing her own thing with some fiction and things like that, which was great. People loved it. And I concentrated on doing product reviews, book reviews, writing articles about, you know, different techniques, different concepts, slowly building my audience. And then eventually I signed a book deal with Ulysses Press, and it's been nothing but writing and speaking and blogging ever since.
Cool, man. That's a really interesting story, and I like the reference back to Y2K. I was about 10 years old when Y2K came around, and it's just kind of like a vague memory for me at this point, but I still remember like hearing all the time on the news, you know, all the reporters and stuff and people freaking out and saying, you know, what's going to happen? Is the world going to end when it hits 2000? So it's kind of cool that kind of reignited this passion in your life. For anyone listening, because I know, I mean, I'm 26 right now. I know, you know, I was 10 at the time. Some of our audience may not remember the Y2K thing. Can you just kind of brief us, some of our listeners, into what that was all about and why people thought the world might end?
As we got closer to the year 2000, I'm going to say it was probably in the mid-90s when this thought first came out, and it built and built and built as we got closer. The basic idea was that when programmers were building computers and programming things, little things like thermostats and computers in your cars and, you know, not necessarily the laptops and the PCs that we all have, but the little things, the things that might not necessarily have a screen, for example, but still are such an important part of our daily lives. The idea was that the programmers, in order to save space, any time they had to put in a date within these computers, they would just use the last two digits for the year. So, for example, for 1997, they would just put 97. Or 1998, 98. And the thought dawned on people in the mid to late 90s, wait a minute, what's going to happen in the year 2000? And suddenly the year is 00. Is that going to screw up all these computers? The computers won't have the data it needs to do this or that. And honestly, it was kind of a ridiculous thing looking back on it. But it was one of those things that just, it literally swept the globe, this hysteria about, oh my God, what's going to happen at midnight, January 1, the year 2000? You know, when the click's over, are all these computers going to go haywire? So you had a lot of these self-professed experts telling you, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, and you should stockpile on your food and invest in some weapons because, oh my gosh, society's going to collapse because cars won't start and this, that, and the other thing. And again, I didn't think this was going to be a big issue, and a lot of very intelligent people who I hung out with thought the same thing. You know, this is ridiculous. But having these topics of food storage, water purification, all these things in the media and in your face made me start thinking about it again. And it was right around the same time that, you know, we started having kids, my wife and I. So, you know, when you're, especially when you're a brand new parent, you really get that papa bear mentality of, you know, I need to protect my family and let's see what we can do about this.
So just kind of last thing on that. So what actually ended up happening when those computers did reset to like zero? Did it just like completely keep working again?
Yeah. Yeah. There may have been isolated instances of, you know, I don't know, a thermostat that didn't click on or something like that, but there was nothing at all that really impacted anybody's life.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think anything happened, but I mean, it's good to, I mean, and the whole thing is, it kind of just shows you how much mass hysteria can make people think that something's going to happen, even if it's something totally ridiculous like the Y2K scare. People were like legitimately terrified in that period of time, and I remember just like all these reports and stuff on those. I was a little kid at the time. I don't really, you know, remember it clearly, but I remember things like people freaking out and thinking the world was going to end. And, you know, it just kind of showed you how much, you know, the media or somebody saying something enough can kind of take over people's minds or even brainwash them into believing something.
Exactly.
So let's kind of dive right into some of this prepping stuff and some of the stuff you talk about in the book. For anyone listening, and, you know, I'm definitely in this category as well, like the newbies of the prepping survival guide community, where is a good place to start? Like, what are some of the resources to check out other than your book? What are some of the things you want to keep in mind, like the basics? Like, what are some of the things, like the essentials that we need if we're thinking about maybe prepping for the future or prepping for some kind of disaster?
Well, if you really want to take it down to a truly basic level, a human being needs four things in order to survive. They need air, they need food, they need water, they need shelter. Everything above and beyond that, if you really want to get technical about it, is a luxury. Okay? Now, the way I approach prepping and survival training and survival instruction is, I don't want to be miserable during a disaster. Yeah, it's possible to have enough water, have enough food, be able to stay warm, and still be truly miserable. I don't want that. I want to be as comfortable as possible under very trying circumstances. I'll admit, you know, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm not a runoff into the woods and live in a grass hut type of guy. Okay. When I was 20, yeah, have at it. Lots of fun. You're in your mid-40s, you wake up, your back hurts, your legs hurt, and you're like, God, this sucks. Okay. That's not me. I don't want to do that. I could if I had to, you know, and it's important to have those skills, but there's, you know, that saying, proper prior planning prevents poor performance. The basic idea is, we have the time now to plan ahead for come what may. Now, if you're starting at zero and you have no concept really of, you know, how this works, step number one is to work on your food storage, your water storage, and think about the types of disasters or emergencies you are likely to face yourself. Now, for food storage, there's a concept out there of, you know, go to one of these websites and buy a pallet load or two pallets of special freeze-dried and dehydrated food that you can keep in your basement for 30 years, and, you know, if disaster ever happens, you can just cook that stuff up and you're good to go. It's an extremely bad plan. Number one, a lot of that stuff doesn't taste all that great, be honest with you. It's extremely high in sodium for the most part, and if you're not accustomed to it, you're not going to enjoy it. On top of that, while you might not agree with the food, even more important is, does it agree with you? It can have very profound effects on your digestive system. If it's already a disaster, you don't want to make things worse. by getting sick. So what I recommend is you stock up on the food you already eat today. Most of us have products and foods that we eat on a regular basis that are already well suited to keep on a shelf for a long period of time. You know, dried pasta, rice, beans, canned goods, things like that. Take a look in your pantry today and look at the different things that you like to eat and then just stock up on those things. What I suggest as a goal when you're just starting out, you're not going to be able to go out and buy, you know, 6 months worth of food. That's ridiculous. Start with a week. Start with just making sure you have enough food in your home at all times that you could feed your entire family for a solid week without having to run to the store. When you reach that point, then shoot for 2 weeks, and then shoot for a month. And do it gradually. Don't try to do it all at once. When you go to the store, check the sale ad, and if, for example, you like boxed pasta, okay, whether it's mac and cheese or whatever, and it's on sale, and you would normally buy 2 boxes, buy 3, and that third one is going to be for your storage, your food storage plan. Same thing with, you know, canned vegetables and, you know, rice and canned soup and stew and all that fun stuff. Build it up over time. That way, number one, you're not having to outlay a whole ton of cash right off the bat. And number two, it's going to build up quickly, and it'll give you a sense of accomplishment when you go to the cupboard and you open it and you can see that you have 2 weeks worth of food in your kitchen. A lot of people today hardly have 3 days worth. You know, build it up over time. With water, same concept applies.
Jim, can I just interject for 1 sec before we touch on water?
Sure.
How long do you have right now for food stores? And then also, isn't some of the food that you have, and this kind of reminds me of like my grandma's house where she has like things from like 10 years ago. I mean, she's a big hoarder, food hoarder, so you'd probably love her. But how long do these stuff, I mean, isn't there expiration dates on some of these things for like a year or so away? Like, is that, you know, viable to have that kind of stuff still?
Sure. When it comes to expiration dates, you have to keep in mind that when it comes to food, expiration dates are not based on the food suddenly goes bad. For example, let's say you pull a can of stew out of your closet or out of your pantry, and the expiration date is December 31st, 2016. That doesn't mean if you open it on January 1st, it's bad. All the expiration date means is that is the last date that the manufacturer will guarantee the product is as good as it can possibly be. And from that date going forward, it will begin to degrade. It doesn't mean it spoils. It just means the texture might not be as good. The flavor might not be as good. But keeping that in mind, a good food storage program incorporates what we call rotation, meaning if I have, it will stay with the stew example. If I have 5 cans of stew in my cabinet, I want to make sure that I use that last can before it expires. And I do that by using those cans regularly and replenishing them as I use them. That way, at all times, you have the freshest possible supply that you can. I would never suggest that you go out and you buy this stuff and throw it on a shelf and forget about it. That's a poor program. You want to incorporate this stuff into your regular diet, eat this stuff on a regular basis, and replenish it as you use it to make sure that you don't end up having this stuff sitting on your shelf and have it go bad on you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to address your other question, asking a prepper, how much food do you have on hand, is like me asking you, Justin, how much money did you make last year? It's one of these questions that you just don't ask.
Okay. Is that potentially for other people trying to take it or something like that?
Yeah, that's where it stems from. But honestly, it's partially that, and even more, it's just an etiquette type of thing.
Okay.
You just don't do it.
Broken the first rule of survival prepper etiquette already, man. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay.
So how much would you recommend then for people optimally, like when they're getting into this stuff? Would you recommend like a year, couple years out if possible? Like, will some of this food last a few years?
Oh, sure. It'll last several years. The part of the problem comes into play is space. You know, where are you going to keep it all? You know, what I suggest people do is this. Again, you want to take a good hard look at the types of emergencies or disasters you feel you are most likely to face. Okay? I nor anybody else is in a position to tell you exactly what to prepare for. My crystal ball stopped working many years ago. Okay, not one of us knows what the future holds. And I'm not going to tell anybody you need to have at least 2 years of food, otherwise you're just going to be screwed. It doesn't work like that. You need to be comfortable with your decision. And if you decide that having a month's worth of food on hand, if you're comfortable with that, great. If you feel you need 6 months, then go for 6 months. If you think a year, go for a year. It all depends on what you are most comfortable with, how much space you have, and how much money you're willing to invest in this over the course of time. Now, to touch on the financial end of it just real brief, one thing to keep in mind is when you're buying food and you're using one of the, you know, a food storage program like this where you're building up a supply, one of the benefits of doing this is you can eat tomorrow at today's prices. When things are on sale, you take advantage of the sale and you save money over the long run. You know, we've all seen food prices don't come down. They go up, just like everything else. Gas and, you know, all your utilities, everything. Prices don't generally fall, not for long-term periods of time. They generally go up. So if I'm able to buy canned stew at, say, 50 cents a can today, when I eat it 6 months from now and the cost is 75 cents, I've saved money.
Yeah, I just remember, like, my dad even telling the stories of, you know, back in the day, he'd get you know, loaf of bread, a bottle of Coke, a comic book, some gum, for all for like 5 cents. So I think you're right, man, for sure on that. All right, so what about water stores? Like, what are we looking at to do with our water?
Well, water is problematic because you can't make it smaller and you can't make it lighter. Water is what it is. If you want dehydrated water, I've got some I can sell you. But generally speaking, you're not going to make it smaller. You're not going to make it lighter. Water weighs roughly 8 pounds a gallon. Okay? It's not light. So you need to keep those things in mind as you decide how much water to store. You've got to have some place to go with it. And depending on your storage method, you may or may not be able to move it once it's there. You know, if you've got a 55-gallon drum full of water, that's great, but you're not moving it anywhere. It's going to stay where you put it. So what various and sundry experts recommend is a minimum of 1 gallon of water per person per day for the expected length of the emergency. So for a family of four, that's 4 gallons a day minimum for however long you feel you're going to be on your own for water. that adds up quick. I mean, just 5 days, that's 20 gallons for a family of four.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's not a small amount.
No.
You know, what I recommend is, number one, that 1 gallon, that is strictly for consumption and a little bit of cleaning. That's it. You're not bathing. You're not taking showers. You're barely washing your hands. If all you have is 1 gallon per person, it's going to go fast. I recommend you look at either, you know, 1.5 to 2 gallons per person to give yourself a cushion. Based on that, you know, if it's 2 gallons, again, for your family of four, that's 8 gallons a day. That's, you know, 56 gallons a week. That's a 55-gallon drum a week just for water. Where the hell are you going to put that, right? What I do is, number one, I buy bottled water when it's on sale. It locally, you know, and prices are obviously going to vary wildly depending on, you know, what part of the country you're in. Where I am in the upper Midwest, I can typically buy a case of bottled water on sale for about $2 to $2.50. So it's not bad. And I'll pick up, you know, 3 or 4 cases when it goes on sale. I'll put it in storage, and then we rotate through, you know, like we do with the food. I try to have as much water on hand as possible. Water, generally, if you buy bottled water, it's not going to go bad. It's not like it's going to spoil or anything like that. As part of the bottling process, it is basically hermetically sealed, in a sense. There's nothing that's going to get into that bottle unless the bottle itself is damaged. Bottled water will last pretty much forever. But we do rotate through, you know, just as it's a good practice, you know, a good habit to have. On top of that, if we have, you know, if we buy bottled juice or, you know, 2 liters of soda, we keep those containers, we wash them out, and then we refill them with water and put them in storage. And again, I mean, for me, that's more like just recycling. You know, that's just, why waste this bottle, and I can use it. And about every 6 months, my wife and I will take those recycled containers and we'll use those for watering plants, things like that, and we'll refill them. Because I'm not a bottler, I can't seal that bottle as well as a manufacturing plant can. I know that, you know, at some point something might get into that water. So every 6 months, we swap it out, use it for, you know, the animals. We'll drink some of it. We'll use it on plants and that, and then we refill it and put it back in storage. You can never have too much water stored. It's very easy to not have enough. You know, I'd rather err on the side of caution and have far more than I'll ever need.
It's very interesting that you said that bottled water pretty much lasts forever, like it won't go bad. I'm thinking of all, like, these kind of health gurus and stuff out there. Not like to knock them, because, you know, sometimes I have these guys on my show. But, no, I mean, as far as, like, people say, or, you know, a lot of people are saying lately, is, like, bottled water has a lot of, like, contaminants in it, or can have contaminants, or, like, if it's in the plastic for a long time, it can go bad, or maybe, you know, give you some of, like, the plastic, like, that you're drinking. What do you think of that? Do you think that there any kind of science behind that?
Well, I think, you know, there are viable concerns, okay? But I look at it like this. Almost every decision a human being makes can be boiled down to a risk versus reward concept, mm-hmm. Okay? No matter what you're talking about. You know, you're at the store and you're looking at, you know, a new iPhone, okay? Is the tongue lashing I'm going to get from my wife worth the reward I'm going to get for having this cool phone, okay? When we talk about bottled water, it's the same thing. You need water to survive. There's no way around it. So we have to look at what is the least riskiest way to have that water on hand. Well, I could fill up rain barrels, which I do, but the risk is contaminants in that water in the rain getting into my body. You know, am I going to be able to filter all that out? Probably, but I could buy a case of bottled water from a reputable company, and I'm reasonably certain that, you know, if, as long as I consume that water within a year or two, it's probably going to be free of contaminants. Every decision you make has some element of risk, but I know for an absolute fact that if I don't have water for a certain period of time, I will die. So it's risk versus reward.
Yeah, and I suppose it's, you know, 100 times better than drinking rainwater or, you know, water that you kind of stumble upon if you're out in the wild or, you know, you're scavenging for it because you didn't save any water.
Well, and that's why, you know, on top of your storage, you should have the means to filter and disinfect what I call wild sources of water, whether it's a pond or a puddle or rainwater or whatever. You should have a filtration device or some other method of making that water potable, be able to drink it, be able to, you know, use it for cooking.
Yeah, I have the Life Straw. Is that a good filter?
It's okay. I prefer the Sawyer brand of products. I personally find them a little bit easier to use.
Mm-hmm.
Katadyn is also very good with their products. Life Straw isn't bad, but they can be difficult to use. The suction process to get that water through can be a little troublesome. Some of the other products I mentioned, the Sawyer and the Katadyn, they don't have those same problems.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna check those out for sure. So the next thing was shelter. What are some of your tips for optimizing your shelter or prepping for the future?
Well, when we talk about shelter, it's kind of an all-encompassing topic. Think of it as an umbrella, no pun intended. Everything and anything that will keep you warm and keep you dry, keep you out of the elements, falls under that shelter umbrella. So in most disasters, we're already going to be in our shelter. We're going to be in our home or, you know, perhaps at work or something like that, but you're going to be within a building. So that is often not as much of a concern as food and water because we're already sheltered. On top of that, always make sure that you are dressed appropriately for the weather. Now, I'm as guilty as anybody else of not wanting to put that parka on in the middle of winter and using my remote start to get my car heated up and then just go from the front door into a warm car and then from a warm car, just a quick dash through the parking lot into work. I do it just like anybody else. But at the same time, I have a parka in my back seat of my car just in case my car breaks down, I get stranded, whatever. I also have a coat sitting in my office at work just in case, you know, the weather turns foul and I've got to go somewhere on foot. I've got a coat that I can use. Obviously, if I'm at home, you know, I've got a closet full of stuff. I'm not too worried about that. On top of clothing and that, the other big part of shelter is fire, being able to make fire. Now, I don't mean necessarily building a campfire in your living room. Okay, that's a bad idea. But we use heat to accomplish many goals. We cook our food with it. We boil water to purify it. At night, if we're outside, it can light up the night and keep the boogeyman away. It keeps us warm. It dries us out. There's a very strong psychological component to fire where if we're able to reliably make fire, we will immediately feel a little bit better about the overall situation. It's the psychological thing. We can control this. The world is falling apart around us. Everything is chaos, but I can control this. It's almost a primal thing. I can tell you from experience, if you take somebody who has never, ever built a fire before, and you take them out into the backyard, and you show them how to lay the sticks properly and how to use tinder, and you give them, you know, a match, you give them a lighter, you give them a ferrocerium rod, and have them strike that spark and get that fire going, the look on their face is just tremendous. it's a very powerful thing. In a survival concept, like I said, you know, fire is very important because it dries us out. It keeps us warm, okay? It keeps us out of the elements. So I think it's important that even if you live in the inner city or you live in a suburb, I don't care where you are, master the ability to make fire and know how to use fire properly. Know how to use it safely. Know how to douse the fire properly so you're not a danger to, you know, creating a wildfire, things like that. But that falls under the shelter concept.
Hey, if you haven't ordered our magnesium citrate yet, do yourself a favor and go to EliteLifeNutrition.com and order our incredible magnesium citrate right now. Each serving provides 200 milligrams of superior and easy-to-absorb magnesium. Chelated with high-potency elemental magnesium citrate, our magnesium is consumed with ease and efficacy. We've cut out all the extra fillers, additives, heavy metals, toxins, and additional junk found in so many other magnesium formulas out there on the market and left you with exactly and only what you need. In fact, you can compare our other ingredients found on the back of every label to that of any other magnesium brand out there because we pride ourselves in giving you only what's necessary to ensure the quality of each and every serving. It's estimated that 80% of the American population is deficient in magnesium, so if you're listening to this, you're probably one of those people. Do yourself a favor, take this supplement. It's going to help you out. It can help in things like energy production, nerve, muscle function, bone health, brain support, anxiety and stress levels. It is an incredible supplement, an incredible mineral, and with Elite Life Nutrition, we've delivered exactly what you need to ensure you're getting the best possible magnesium out there. Go to EliteLifeNutrition.com and check it out now. You're going to love this.
Yeah, I'm just thinking to like some of the shows I've seen where some of these people are in the wild, you know, even like survivalists who've like been doing this all their life, and just how tough it is for them to start a fire if they don't have the right materials, you know, like rubbing sticks together. Like that's, I mean, people that have been doing this their entire lives couldn't even start a fire doing that kind of technique. What do you recommend that people kind of carry on them or maybe have in storage so that they don't have to do that?
I'll tell you something. I know a lot of survival instructors. I know guys who quite literally could walk off into the woods carrying nothing but a pocket knife and a month later come riding out on a bicycle that they made from scratch, okay? Every single one of them carries a Bic lighter in their pocket.
Wow.
Okay? I don't care how long they've been at it. I don't care how many different fire starting techniques they know. Every one of them carries a Bic lighter in their pocket. Okay? It's instant fire. Strike anywhere matches are another one. You know, there are innumerable little waterproof containers that you can fill with Strike Anywhere matches. You can take the matches and dip them in melted wax and make them waterproof individually, you know. Have the means to create fire in an instant. Lighter, matches. I like to use a ferrocerium rod, or a ferro rod is the shortened term. It's basically a length of material that you strike or scrape with a knife blade, a piece of glass, a rock, things like that. It's like a flint and steel, but you get a lot more sparks out of it. I like to use those. I think they're fun. Most fires that I make, I use a ferro rod, but I've still got that lighter in my pocket. Other methods, you know, the traditional flint and steel. And then, you know, you look at primitive methods like the bow drill. You know, the joke with the bow drill is it warms you up twice. It warms you up while you're struggling to get the fire going, and then the fire itself will keep you warm too. There's so many different tools out there that'll do it. What I recommend people do is invest in some of these tools and then play around with them in the backyard. Learn how they work, learn how to operate them properly, And, you know, everybody's a little bit different. I like a ferro rod. I know people who don't. I know people who, they prefer a bow drill. Well, have at it. You know, I don't care how you get the fire lit, just as long as you know how to do it.
Yeah, I agree, man. I think that's, you know, really sound advice. So the fourth element, you know, the basic primitive elements that we all need for safety was air. Was there anything, I mean, this might be a silly question, but was there anything to optimize your air or, you know, be safe with that going forward?
Well, what I tell people is this. If you get into a position where air is a concern, you have a lot bigger problems on your hands than trying to figure out where you're going to sleep that night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Particularly for urban dwellers or people who work in an urban area, one of the things I do recommend is that you invest in a few what are called N, that's N like Nancy, 95 masks. They look like surgical masks, but they're a little bit thicker material. They're a dust mask is what it boils down to, okay? Why should you have these? Well, think back to 9/11. Think about all the photos you saw of people fleeing the area. And what did they look like? They were absolutely covered in dirt and dust from head to toe. And you could hardly see some areas because there was so much floating debris in the air. Have a couple of these masks with you at work, in your car, whatever, so that way if something, God forbid, were to happen, it will help you to breathe a little bit easier. You might also want to invest, you know, while we're on the topic, invest in a pair of safety goggles. So that way, you know, your eyes aren't being affected by all that stuff floating around. Other than that, there's not a whole lot you're going to be able to do about air. You're either going to have it or you don't. Granted, there are, you know, products out there, portable oxygen tanks, and I think there's a new one I saw the other day that's coming out on the market specifically for skiers, where it's like this little oxygen supply that you strap to your back like a vest, where if you're in an avalanche, it gives you air to breathe while you're waiting to be rescued.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, the products are out there, but, you know, for my money, I would rather spend money on food and water and shelter, and, you know, the odds of me needing assistance to breathe through, you know, some type of oxygen device, in my circumstances, it's going to be fairly remote.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as big of a concern for me as it might be for some other people.
Jim, what are some of the essential, like, equipment that you recommend people have? Like you mentioned earlier, you know, a pocket knife or Bic lighters. Like, is there any other things that kind of pop to mind?
Well, I think some form of cutting tool is essential because you find yourself using it constantly. I'm not suggesting everybody go out and buy, you know, a 12-inch Rambo knife or some, you know, ridiculous survival knife. But, you know, at the minimum, have like a little Swiss Army knife or, you know, some other type of pocket knife. If you're going to be spending, if you're likely to spend a fair amount of time outdoors, invest in a good quality fixed blade knife, you know, something by LT Wright or Bark River, you know, a good manufacturer who knows what they're doing. Don't go to the dollar store and pick up a steak knife or a butcher's knife and say, okay, I'm done. You know, you're setting yourself up for failure. Invest in a good quality knife, whether it's a pocket knife or a fixed blade or both, you know, whatever your preference. The other thing that is very difficult to produce from wild materials is what we call cordage, you know, rope, string. It's certainly possible. You know, I can do it. I know a lot of guys who can do it. It's a pain in the ass. It takes a long time, and your energy is better focused elsewhere rather than trying to make yourself rope. So you could go out and buy one of those ever popular bracelets, those woven paracord bracelets, it's not a bad idea, provided you know how to unravel it rather than trying to cut it, because cutting it it defeats your purpose. Otherwise, you know, what I do and what I know some other people will do, they take an old credit card or an old gift card. You wrap the gift card with your cordage, your paracord or bank line or whatever. Just wrap it around there several times. You'll get many feet of cordage to fit on that gift card, and it stores it flat and stores it tangle-free. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you slip that in your pocket or in your purse or your backpack or whatever, and you've always got some on you just in case you need it. Cool. The other one more essential for my way of thinking is a flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't carry a flashlight for a long time, not because I was against it in any way. It never really dawned on me. You know, what the hell do I need a flashlight for? And then I bought this one called a ProTac 1 AAA by a company called Streamlight. The love I have for this thing is obscene. It really is. I use this thing every single day of my life, and it's one of those things that when you start carrying it, you start to wonder, how the hell did I live this long without carrying a flashlight? I use it all the time. And it's small. It's honestly, if you take two AAA batteries and lay them end-to-end, that's about how big this flashlight is, all told.
Wow.
It's nothing. Sitting in my pocket all day long. I don't even feel it. I don't know that it's there. But when I need it, boom. And it's bright, and it's sturdy. I've been carrying mine for almost 2 years now, and it has never failed me once.
That's pretty cool, man. So which one is it called? The ProTac
1 AAA? It's called the ProTac, ProTac. The number 1, and then AAA, AAA.
Yeah, I'm gonna,
because it uses 1 AAA battery.
Okay, cool. So that's pretty reasonable. And how long does the battery last for, like, typically?
Like I said, I use mine a ton, and I get probably a good 6 months out of a battery.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's not like it's, you know, suddenly one day it doesn't work because the battery died. It's a gradual thing. You'll notice that the light starts to dim over time, and that's your cue to change the battery.
All right, cool. Yeah, I'm gonna link up some of these things you're mentioning in the show notes too, if anyone wants to check them out, because I think they're, you know, obviously really good resources. As far as that kind of just brought up another question, though. As far as the batteries go, like, how would you save batteries for long-term use? I think they kind of go bad after a while, right?
Well, they do. You know, alkaline batteries, lithium batteries, they're a lot better today than they were even 5 years ago in terms of both the power they generate and the length of time that they last. Now, when I say the power they generate, I understand, you know, a battery is designed to output a specific amount of power in a device. But the length of time that it'll give out that power, as well as the length of time that it'll remain viable on the shelf, is a lot better today than it was even 5 years ago. So with that said, you know, leading up to Christmas is a great time to buy batteries because they're on sale everywhere. I'll usually pick up a few packages at least. On top of that, invest in a way to recharge batteries. You know, buy rechargeables and then have a way to charge them that does not require a wall outlet. Best way is a small solar panel. You go to a company like Goal Zero or I can't think of the other one now, Sun something. I can't think of the name of it. They both have very good small solar panels that fold up. They're about the size of a spiral notebook that you may have used in school. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you unfold it, just set it in your window. It connects to a little charger that you put your batteries in and just let it sit.
Wow.
It uses solar energy to power to charge those batteries. Now, there's another company out there who's doing something that when I tell people about this, they don't believe me. He has a device, and I've used it. I recommend it. It works. It literally uses salt water to charge batteries. Okay? Company is called Greenovative. Just put that into Google and you'll find his site. It's a little device that there are these metal, I don't know what the proper term for them is, but there's little metal knobby things, okay, in this compartment that you fill with salt water. The salt water reacts with this metal and it generates electricity, and the electricity is shunted into charging these batteries. It's ridiculously simple to use, and it works for a long, long time. Okay, so that's another method or tool that you can use to charge batteries over the long term. Now, going back to those solar panels, you can get panels and chargers that you can charge your tablets. You can charge your laptops. You can charge all this stuff. I mean, you're not going to be able to power a refrigerator with one of these little solar panels, but you can, you know, keep yourself in the loop with communication with, you know, social media and otherwise to keep abreast of what's going on around you.
That's really cool, man. And how long will, like, a rechargeable battery, how long will they last for on one of these things? Like, is it, like, infinite?
It's not infinite. They do degrade over time. We have some at home that they're starting to degrade. They're starting to not hold a charge for as long or not hold as much of a charge. And we've had the batteries for a couple of years, and we're constantly rotating them through. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind too. I mean, we have, like, say, four sets of AA batteries that we are constantly using up, recharging, in different cameras and things like that. So we probably use those batteries a lot more than the average person would.
Yeah.
So, and we're still getting, you know, a year or two out of them. You know, the average person probably get them to run far longer than that.
So are the batteries themselves rechargeable batteries too? Or are they just regular batteries?
What do you mean?
Is it the solar panels, like the, is that what's doing the charging, or do you need the solar panels plus the batteries, or like specific batteries, I mean, or are they just like regular?
You don't need specific types of batteries. The solar panels, they'll have I'll just call it a charger, this little device that, you know, your regular rechargeable AA or AAA batteries will fit into. You plug that into the solar panel and it just does the work for you.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah.
What we do is I've got a solar panel. It sits in this one window of my living room 24/7. Obviously, it doesn't do anything at night, but I never move it. It just sits in my window, and I'm just swapping batteries out of the charger all the time. It works great.
Mm-hmm. Cool, man. Yeah, that is really interesting, and I think it's a great idea. Jim, just a few more questions, man. Then we got to sort of wrap things up.
Yeah.
It's been an awesome interview so far, man. I do appreciate it. So, what are some of the, I guess, kind of basic survival skills that people should know? I mean, we mentioned some of the ways to prep. Is there anything, like, intuitively that they should kind of have an understanding for how to do, like maybe grow food or maybe hunt or, like, I don't know, any of those things you think are kind of essential?
I think anything that makes you more self-reliant is a benefit. Anything that you can do to increase your ability to provide for your basic needs is a bonus, okay? Pretty much anybody, no matter where they live, is able to grow at least some food. Not saying it's going to be a lot. I mean, if you live in a condo and you're, you know, 30 stories up, no, you're not going to be growing corn and everything else, but you could easily have a tomato plant and you could grow some lettuce, things like that right on your patio, okay? Anything you can do to produce some amount of food, I think, is beneficial. I mean, not just for a self-reliance standpoint, but you know what you're eating. You know what went into that. And it gives you a better appreciation for the amount of work that goes into producing food, which I think is important, and it's a lesson that's been lost for the last few generations. I think another skill that's important that's also been lost is the ability to navigate. We live in an age where if I want to know how to get from point A to point B, I pull out my phone, put in an address, and it literally tells me exactly where I need to go, when I need to turn, and how far I need to go before the next turn. It's wonderful. It's a great tool, but I often wonder how many people under the age of, say, 20 could read a map without a voice telling them what to do. You know, it's easy to develop a sense of direction. It takes a little bit of time, but if you practice it, you will begin to intuitively know what direction you're facing at any given time, north, south, east, or west. Okay? After you've kind of mastered that, you're in a much better position of being able to tell on your own where you need to go in an emergency or even just, you know, to get from point A to point B. You need to know where you are before you can figure out how to get to where you're going. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's step number one. And I think that's a skill that's been lost. And it's not that hard to regain it. It just takes a little bit of time and a little bit of practice. Hunting, fishing, trapping, that kind of stuff. Yeah, those are great skills, but if I live on the 35th floor of a high-rise, I'm probably not going to be doing a whole lot of hunting, and I'm certainly not going to be doing a lot of fishing from up there. They're great skills to have. Personally, I think everybody needs to spend at least some time wetting a line, meaning going, sitting on the bank of a lake, a river, a stream, whatever, and fishing, even if you don't catch anything. That's secondary. Yeah. It's a meditative thing, you know, being outside and just hanging out, okay? But being able to grow some food, being able to know where you are and how to get from point A to point B, these are things that are very important in an emergency, in a disaster, and they're easy to learn. They're not necessarily easy to do, but they're easy to learn the basic concepts and then just build on them from there.
Yeah, I agree, man. I like some of those tips for sure. And, you know, I definitely personally have to get better at growing food or at least learn the skill of it because I've never really been able to do it. But, yeah, it's something I have to touch up on. Jim, as far as money goes, do you recommend people, like I hear this on a lot of the shows like the Doomsday Prepper shows and, you know, the other things like that, saving up on like silver or gold even. Do you recommend people do that?
Yes, but only to a degree. The basic idea behind it is that way if the dollar were to collapse or the euro or, you know, wherever you are, whatever the currency is where you live, if that currency were to collapse, having gold and silver on hand would allow you to still make purchases and pay for things. On paper, it's a great idea. In practice, it can be a little troublesome. Okay. Number one, I could invest thousands of dollars in silver and gold and have it sitting at home. Mm-hmm. And let's say the dollar collapses and I want to go buy a loaf of bread. So I go to the baker and I say, okay, I want to trade you this silver coin for that loaf of bread. What are the odds that the baker is going to have any ability at all to determine to his own comfort level that what I'm handing him is truly silver?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that's where it starts to fall apart, at least from my perspective. In order to have a successful business transaction, you have to have two parties involved, and both parties have to agree on the terms. Otherwise, it falls apart, right? Whether you're buying a car, a loaf of bread, or a plane ticket, you have money. The other person has what you want. That other person has to agree to accept what you're offering for money in exchange for that item. If they don't agree to it, you don't get that thing. And you're just sitting there with your money. You can't eat it. You can't drink it. You can't do anything with it other than try to buy things. That said, the concept that's very popular in the prepper slash survival world is barter and trade, where instead of stocking up on thousands of dollars of silver and gold, I'm going to buy things that are tangible items that are likely to have value in a post-collapse society. Things like medical supplies, tobacco, alcohol, sewing things like needles and thread and patches and fabric, things that people are not going to be able to necessarily produce on their own, but they're going to either want them or need them at some point during a long-term grid-down situation. Mm-hmm. On top of items, there are also certain skill sets that, you know, you kind of look at them as your post-collapse occupation, whether it's you're the seamstress and you're able to mend clothing, or, you know, one of the things I like to tell people is, yeah, if you know how to provide and produce the hooch, you will never go hungry a day in your life. If you can produce the alcohol, you will have friends forever, and you will never starve. even if you have skill at hunting and trapping, you can trade some of the meat you've harvested for other things you need. Gold and silver is great, and, you know, it's not a bad idea to have some, but don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, if you're going to invest in some type of post-collapse currency, so to speak, diversify your investments and try to cover as many bases as you can.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, man, for sure. And I'm glad you kind of cleared that up, too, because I was kind of thinking that it was a, you know, great idea, but it makes a lot of sense of, you know, people aren't going to be, I mean, if this was like 500 years ago or something where that's all they had was like silver and gold, or, you know, they actually knew what a real piece of silver looked like, it makes a ton of sense, like you're saying. But people, I mean, 2017, I don't know what a piece of silver looks like. I don't know what real silver looks like, or real gold looks like. And I think the majority, maybe like 99% of the American population has no idea what the hell, you know, real silver or gold looks like. So it makes, you know, it makes a lot of sense to kind of barter, have things that people actually know, you know, their value of, instead of just, you know, something like that.
Well, and one of the things you can do is you scope out and you watch for what we call junk silver. Junk silver refers to United States coins that actually have real silver in them, unlike most of the coins that we use today. Anything, any quarters or dimes, I think it is, that were produced or minted prior to 1965 actually have real silver in them, and those are called junk silver. They're actually worth far more than face value, okay? The value is determined by, you know, what is silver going for at that moment in time when you have it in your hand, but generally speaking, it's worth a lot more than, you know, 25 cents or 10 cents. So what I do and what I recommend people do is, a lot of us have some type of coin jug or container at home where at the end of the day we toss our coins in there because we're saving up for Disneyland or whatever. Before you toss your coins in there, take a look at them and look for junk silver and have another container somewhere else where you put that stuff, okay? You're not going to find a lot of it. There's not a ton of it floating around anymore, but it is out there. I just found a quarter last week, okay? Been a while since I found a quarter, but by God, there it is. It goes into a little jug. That jug is my junk silver that, you know, push come to shove, and I need to, you know, make a purchase of something after the dollar collapses. I have, you know, silver that I can use, and it's pretty universally recognized that, you know, these coins are actually worth real money as opposed to the fake money that we have today. At least that's, you know, how a lot of people refer to it.
Jim, so let's get kind of, I guess, put on your Nostradamus cap for a sec. I know you mentioned earlier you've never had a crystal ball or it stopped working years ago. But if you had to guess, or maybe just, you know, weighing options, what are some of the highest chances for some kind of doomsday scenario to unfold? Like, what what are the more likely scenarios, if anything? I know that all these things are very low anyways, but what are like the more likely things that could potentially happen at some point in the future?
Well, there's a couple of them that I tend to pay more attention to than I do others, okay? I'm not saying that they're likely. What I'm saying is, in the grand scheme of things, you know, this is more likely to happen than that,
mm-hmm.
okay? But you have to understand, it's kind of like the average Joe Schmo walking into a Victoria's Secret model run, okay, where they're unveiling all the new outfits. And he looks at the blonde and he says, I'm more likely to go home with her than I am more likely to go home with the brunette sitting next door. The odds are still very, very remote, okay? We're not saying that either of them are likely to happen. What we're saying is one thing is just that hair more likely. One of them for me is the Yellowstone caldera. A lot of people know this. Some of them don't. Yellowstone out west is actually sitting on a giant volcano. And various and sundry experts have predicted that it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when it's going to blow. And when it does, it's not going to be a little thing. It's going to be huge, and it's going to probably have a global impact when all is said and done. So that's one of the things I, you know, tend to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is what we call EMP, or electromagnetic pulse. The basic concept is that either a solar event or a man-made device can create this pulse of energy that will disable a lot of our modern electronic devices, including vehicles and computers and all this fun stuff. Are either of these things likely to happen? Probably not. But in the grand scheme of things, I think the Yellowstone caldera blowing is more likely than, say, us being invaded by an extraterrestrial army, okay?
Yeah.
Or a zombie uprising, you know? Like I said, it's not like, you know, we get up in the morning and, you know, we sit and we chew our nails all day long just waiting for it to blow. It's if a long-term event is going to happen, that's one of the causes I look at being likely.
I actually haven't heard of the Yellowstone caldera. I heard of the EMP thing, I think, on one of those shows that I have watched in the past, like the electricity basically shutting down. You know, whether that was solar or man-made, you know, either way, it can kind of be, you know, very tough because we kind of live our lives around electricity. But yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Just preparing for the worst, but not necessarily living your life like, oh yeah, I wake up every morning petrified because I think the Yellowstone caldera has a, you know, 5% chance of going off sometime in the next 100 years, whatever it is.
Right.
I'm just making that number up. But yeah, it makes sense, man, to just be prepared for the worst. But live life, obviously, now and enjoy what's happening.
Preppers and survivalists are not all gloom and doom, like many people think. We're actually, if you really think about it, we are the eternal optimists because we look at all these potentially negative things that can happen, whether it's a blizzard or a power outage or EMP or a pandemic or whatever. And we are actively making plans to survive and thrive in the face of these calamities. That's optimism. That's not being pessimistic. That's being optimist.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a great point. I never really thought of it that way, but you're right. You're prepping yourself for the future, you know, in the worst case scenario that something like this happens, but you have that optimism that by preparing yourself, you're going to be okay. You know, it's really cool to think of it that way.
Exactly.
Jim, sort of the last question on prepping stuff, but do you recommend people have some sort of protection? Like we mentioned guns earlier or hunting, like do you recommend people go out and, you know, exercise their Second Amendment right and get a gun just for safety reasons?
I do, but I do it with caution. What I recommend is you seek out training in how to use a firearm. And I don't mean go to one of these gun schools where they're going to put you through all this tactical training and turn you into a quasi special forces SWAT team dude. Learn how to handle a firearm properly. Learn how to handle it safely. Learn how to load it, how to unload it, how to shoot it. Learn, you know, become comfortable with it. Now, I can tell you this. Without exception, every single person I have ever known in life who was very anti-gun, they didn't think people should have them, they didn't like them, yada, yada, yada. If I or somebody else were finally able to get them to a gun range and just spend 10 minutes showing them some basics and letting them fire off at a few targets, they tend to change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I don't mean it turns them into some type of bloodthirsty, you know, goon. It's just a hell of a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
To go to a range and, you know, we call it range therapy. You know, you're having a bad day, things just aren't going right, you need some range therapy. Get your handgun, get some ammo, go down to the range and spend an hour shooting at paper targets. You'll feel better when you're all done. I think that we as human beings, we have the right to defend ourselves, okay? I'm not saying that we need to walk around armed to the teeth and go looking for trouble by any means, okay? But what I'm saying is we need to get back to a point where we are able to fend for ourselves at least to a degree, okay? There's a quote on the top of my website, survivalweekly.com. It was written by Scott Williams, who was the author who initially introduced me to my publisher, Ulysses Press. He wrote this as in the foreword to one of my books. Okay? He says, "Survival is not the exclusive right of any particular political organization or religious affiliation. The right to live and to defend and protect your loved ones is the most fundamental of all rights." And I believe that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're not comfortable with a firearm, find something else. You know, a stun gun, pepper spray. Take self-defense classes. Learn how to defend yourself. Not so much because I want you to turn into the ultimate badass who can take on, you know, any group of thugs. But when you take a class like that, one of the first things you're going to learn is how to hold yourself and look confident, how to hold your head up, how to put your shoulders back, how to look at the world around you and pay attention to the things that are happening instead of staring in your phone and updating Facebook every 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those things in and of themselves will make you a much less likely target for burglars and muggers and all that fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, man, for sure. Jim, it's been a fantastic interview, man. Is there any last send-off or takeaway message you'd like to leave our audience and then also a place that our listeners can check out more about you?
Well, the last thing I would say is this. Don't be afraid of the stigma that you might have or you might see when it comes to prepping and survival planning. The vast majority of us are people, regular people just like you. We're just, you know, looking towards the future and wanting to be a little better prepared. Yeah, there is this small fringe element, you know, the class 1000 whack jobs that are out there. But the vast majority of us are just normal people just like you, you know. If you want to learn more about me and learn more about prepping and survival planning, head to survivalweekly.com. I also have a consulting business, disasterprepconsultants.com. And I'm extremely active on Facebook, facebook.com/JimCobbSurvival.
Awesome, man. I really appreciate you coming on, Jim, and sharing these awesome tips with our audience. And I learned a ton, man. So thank you so much. And thanks so much, man. And I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
As always, if you haven't joined the Elite Man Mastermind group on Facebook yet, do yourself a big favor and get on that right now. Connect with thousands of guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves every single day. This is the best Facebook group on the planet, totally free, and this is going to push you, motivate you, inspire you, give you tips, advice, and strategies for helping you master the biggest challenges in your life. EliteManMastermind.com will take you right to the group on Facebook where you can join. It's a closed group, which means it might take a couple minutes, a couple hours for you to get accepted in by one of the moderators or myself, but I promise you we will get you in if you're not a spammer and you don't have a creepy profile. So go to EliteManMastermind.com if you haven't yet. Join the group. You're going to absolutely love this and join a collection of thousands of amazing guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves and help you out along the way.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.